It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And this is the last edition of this year where we will have regular season games left to talk about. So that definitely it colors everything. I mean, as you start talking about, you know, and we've talked about this a good bit, and I think most people playing know this, but you know, the only thing that matters now, unless you're in some kind of keeper league, is what somebody can do for you over the next week, and that should color all your decisions and should play into, you know, remembering about big names. Big names don't do you a whole lot of good over 8 days if they're not going to play. So let's get right to it. Tim Anderson, really been hot lately. There's a lot to like there. There are also some things not to like. Is he the next Jonathan Scope, or is he a guy who that absolutely awful strike zone judgment will eventually eat into his production?
Yeah, I'm going to largely go with the second one. I mean, okay, so since September 3rd, he's hitting 439, but that 439 comes with a 574 BABIP, so that's a good 200 to 200, yeah, probably 250 points higher than it should be. Since September 3rd, 17 strikeouts, one walk. So we're not really seeing differences really in his plate skills. We're just seeing some good luck here. Now, he has swiped 8 bases since September 3rd, and I think that's a little encouraging. Now, with less trips to base, he would have less bases to swipe, but even if he had swiped 3 or 4 since September 3rd, that would be pretty notable in an era where there aren't many good base dealers. And Anderson is someone who we knew as fast when he came to the majors, and prior to this month, hadn't really been stealing bases. So I'm a little optimistic maybe that we could see more stolen bases. Maybe next year we could see a 25-steal season, but I think we're still sitting in the range of a 260 hitter with poor strike zone judgment. He also does have 16 home runs this year, which boosts his value a little bit. Like, if you could count on him for a double-digit home run total even next year, then that means something too.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The one thing I would note is the guy's got 25 homers and 1,000 big league plate appearances. So, you know, I don't think 15 is unreasonable to think next year he hasn't played a full season. You know, if it's 15 and 25 and 250, that's a player you don't mind having in a lot of leagues.
Yeah, I totally agree. I haven't come to the point where I'm expecting him, if he could just draw some more walks, like 13 last year in 99 games, 13 this year in 136 games, his walk rate's even gone down. Like, if he could just get that walk rate up to 35 or something in a season, I think that would make a real difference, because that's more time standing on first base, giving him a chance to steal. I think I need to see that steal total continue to, you know, to stay up where it's been in September, I think, to start considering him in the 10-team leagues.
Same team, very different skill set. Yoel Moncada is starting to show some of the things that people have long thought he would show. And one of the things he has always had and has continued to display is some grasp of the strike zone. He'll take his walks. He does strike out, but he has shown some of the strike zone judgment that he did not show during a very brief cup of coffee last year. 7 home runs in 189 plate appearances, but Moncada has 3 steals and 189 plate appearances in 44 games with the White Sox. Is your view of him for next year any altered, either by him starting to hold his own at the plate or by how little he has run? In other words, have you adjusted your read on him upward or downward since he started playing regularly?
I think maybe downward a little bit, but I'm trying not to get too into small sample sizes at the start of his career. I mean, he's someone like this month, he's starting to hit for average. Like, he's hitting 328 this month. Again, some bad ball luck, but at least he's showing that can happen. I'm not counting on him, though. The lure of Moncada for me, at least for, say, next season, wasn't a high batting average. So I was just hoping for a 250, 260 average. It was the possibility of 20 and change home runs, but then 30-something steals. And if you could be a 20-homer, 35-steal player, you're really, really valuable, even if you're hitting 250. So the steals, the lack of the green light there, or the success stealing, is a bit of a concern. That being said, like, he really showed a lot of speed in the minors. Like Matthew, if I said he was going to steal 30 bases next year, would you take the over or under on that? Let's say he plays in 140 games next year, and I said 30.
Well, that's what's so weird, and that's what I'm still not sure about, because he has just run so little. It's baffling that he's not even trying. So I would have thought that was a slam dunk 2 months ago. If you just told me before he started playing regularly, without knowing a thing about what he'd do as a big leaguer this year, you just said next year, 30 stolen bases in regular playing time, I'd say, yeah, he's going to hit that. Just because of what he has done in the minors. But, you know, five attempts in almost a third of a season is really weird. So I don't know what to make of that. This is a guy who not only stole a lot of bases, but stole at a high success rate. You know, was a good base stealer in the minors. So it's kind of baffling, and I'm curious to see where it goes, because he is getting on base. You know, it's not like Tim Anderson. He's got a 340, 350 on base. He's getting opportunities. He's just not going, and you would think, you know, for one thing, for a team that's out of it, you would think you would want him learning. You would think you would want him, even if he makes mistakes, even if he gets caught, see how a big league pitcher and catcher caught you and apply that to next time. But he's not even trying, so it's a weird thing.
It is baffling. I will say I'm probably going to chalk it up. I'm probably going to give him the benefit of the doubt. He's so talented that I'll probably give him the benefit of the doubt in next year's rankings, and I'm not going to predict, like, this 40 steal season, but I am going to probably predict at least high 20s or something along those lines. I'm not sure, and I haven't read anything about why they're not giving him the green light, but the fact that we know from the minors he can steal bases, and the fact that he's already shown that he can get on base around a 350 on base percentage in the majors, I'm probably going to give him the benefit of the doubt for one more year, but it's less of a lock. It's less of someone who you can count on for steals, right, like you can some of those other elite base stealers.
Fred, I don't know what's going on here, but you've just – all I know is I suddenly have craving for an Italian beef sandwich. Avisaíl García, we stick with the White Sox. Not a guy I've ever really been high on, not a guy we were high on. He's hitting 333. I still don't completely believe it, but two things about that. One is – this is a guy who could be available and a guy who could get you some base hits. If you are at, you know, 2.789 and the person in front of you is at 2.790, maybe a few hits from Avisaíl García make a difference. The other thing about him, and there are a couple guys that I do want to mention this that are on our list today, a couple guys I want to mention this about today. García's only 26, and he has been around forever. He is, of course, on his second team, but he is a guy who it feels like he is 29 and just never delivered. He's 26. He's coming into his prime. So if somebody wanted to argue that this is him arriving at a new level rather than just a career season or a hot streak, I'd have to listen to it. Where do you come down on that with him?
Yeah, I could listen to it, but I'm with you where I'm still pretty skeptical on him. I mean, if we look at really this is just a batting average change. Like, he has 17 home runs, which is, like, not in this season, not special at all, especially for an outfielder, and is really related. It's a little better, his home run per plate appearance, you know, is a little better than the past couple of years, but not much. So not power steal, 5 steals and 8 attempts, so not a base stealer. He's just hitting 333, which has spurred the 77 RBI in 126 games. But his BABIP's 396. So that's probably a good 50 to 60 points unsustainable. So he's probably, if I was thinking next year, a 270 type hitter. And when I try to look for underlying changes that maybe could support a higher BABIP, I don't really see them. Like, this is still someone, his line drive rate, his ground ball rate, his fly ball rate, his hard contact rate are all pretty much the same as previous years. So I think this is just a 270 hitter who's had some good luck this year. I won't be probably owning him in any leagues next year.
One thing I would note is that his strikeout rate has come down a little bit. He was always a guy who struck out too much to be the kind of high average hitter that I think people hoped he would be, and that maybe there was some impression he would be. But, you know, he struck out 23% of the time in 15. 26% of the time in 2016. That's down to 20% this year. And so that would be one thing that I think you could be sustainable And one thing that could be, again, as you note, like the BABIP probably doesn't stay this high, but you know, if you cut your strikeout rate from 25% to 20%, then you don't need to get quite as many base hits on balls in play. So I think that is one reason to be encouraged. I'm still broadly with you. I'm not really buying it, but I do think that's encouraging. You know, he's a guy who in some ways his numbers always kind of looked a little like a guy who was his teammate earlier this year, Melky Cabrera. You kind of thought maybe he was like a Melky starter kit. Well, you know, one thing that Melky always said, he never struck out a lot. He's never struck out a lot in his career. If Garcia can get to be that kind of hitter, then he's got a better chance to match him in some of the other ways.
Yeah, that's right. And for Garcia, being a 270 or 275 hitter would be an improvement. Like, I know his career average is 277, but that's heavily influenced by this season. If you look at last year, 245, the year before, 257, the year before that, 244, like a 270 or 280 hitter with that reduced strikeout rate would be a nice jump for him. I just don't – yeah, he hasn't jumped to 333.
Josh Donaldson, 30 homers in relatively limited time this year. I am still a little worried about him for next year. Again, I think we're going to talk a lot about guys' ages this year, this week, because in part because we're going to be talking a little bit about looking at guys for 2018. Donaldson turns 32 in December, and it's not like you can't be productive, but he's kind of the opposite of a guy like Garcia. I think he's older than a lot of people are inclined to think because he emerged so late. His first full big league season was his age 27 season. So while it's definitely encouraging to see Donaldson bounce back, I kind of feel like the real Donaldson is the whole year. It's not the hot streak. It's not the struggles earlier in the year. It's the whole year. And that's a really good player. That is going to be north of 30 home runs. That is 266 average, but a 387 on base. And for the few of you who play fantasy for whom that matters, that is a guy who, if you prorate out his RBI and runs, 250 games, 100 RBI, 85 runs. But the two things are, one, again, I think that the full season is probably the fair thing because as guys get older, they're more prone to have the kinds of nagging injuries that can sap your production. And also because if he's still with Toronto next year, and that's not a given, and that would adjust my view of him if he got traded somewhere where he could be in the heart of a really dangerous lineup, that might adjust it. But as you've talked about a good bit, Blue Jays lineup is not what it was, and there's no guarantee that Bautista's back, even if Donaldson is back. And so, you know, it's entirely possible he could be a 30-plus home run guy again next year and not be the 123 RBI, 122 run guy that he was 2 years ago. So I like Donaldson. I think it's good to see him come back some. I don't think he has regained his perch as a first-round type hitter to me. Where do you see him for next year?
Yeah, I see him in a group of second-round sluggers where it depends how you want to set up your team. If you went pitcher in the first round, if you went speed in the first round, but maybe someone wants to start with two sluggers. But I see him in a group of a kind of a cluster of second-round picks. I think from a skills perspective, I'm not doubting him at all. Now his OPS looks almost the same as it did during the previous two seasons. His home run rate, you know, per plate appearance is maybe even a little better, but basically the same. His batting average has dropped a bit, but so has his BABIP a little bit. So if it normalized, he's basically the same, like 280 type hitter. So he can be I think he could be, if he stays healthy, and he was really durable prior to this year, he could be the 35 to 40 home run, 280 type hitter. But you're right, the lineup to me, and I do think he'll be in Toronto next year, at least for part of the year, if not all of it. And I do think the lineup gives me reason for pause. And then it's the question of the durability. Do you believe the previous four seasons where he played 155 or more games, or do you believe this year where he'll end up around 110? And or 115 or so, and that there's a big difference there with someone on the wrong side of 30. So I think owners are going to have to make some tough calls in round two if they want to go with a power hitter where they can look at Donaldson or J.D. Martinez or Joey Votto or Freddie Freeman or Anthony Rizzo. Maybe even Chris Bryant falls into round two in a lot of drafts next year. And then, you know, you're going to have to pick the one that you feel the best about. And there are some reasons to maybe put Donaldson near the back of that pack.
We have talked a lot about Rhys Hoskins. Baseball has talked a lot about Rhys Hoskins. He's one of the biggest stories in the game. And yet somehow Matt Olson, who is doing similar kinds of things, has not become quite as big a story around baseball. We talked about him a couple of weeks ago. How big is the separation between these two guys as you look at 2018?
Yeah, I think in my mind the separation is mostly about batting average. I think that with Hoskins, I feel like there's a better chance that he can be a 290 type hitter, whereas Olsen, I know his BABIP is low. It's 245. Now, he hits a lot of fly balls, so he may be prone to a bit to a low BABIP. But with Hoskins, I feel like there's maybe a little better strike zone control, higher walk rate, and I think maybe Hoskins can be more closer to a 300 hitter, whereas Olsen, I feel like, maybe settles in as a 260, 270 type hitter. But as far as which one hits more home runs next year, I think that's a legit question. And they both are playing in lineups that probably won't be last in baseball next year in run score, but probably won't be in the top half of the league either. So I think once we get past the real established superstar sluggers, they'll both be options, and I wouldn't be surprised to see them fall. I think they should fall within a round or two of each other. Do you see a big gap between them?
I don't. One thing I would note is the ballpark is a difference for sure. I like Hoskins' chances to take advantage of his ballpark more. These guys both displayed really nice strike zones in the minors. I mean, they both were power hitters. I mean, I know, Olsen has some high strikeout seasons in the minors, but they were all in pretty high plate appearance totals, and he matched that with high walk totals. So this is a guy who has some control of the strike zone, which gives me some hope that he's not going to be a Chris Davis 220 kind of hitter. I think the gap between them is narrow. I think I would probably rather have Hoskins because, as you note, the batting average, and again, because I like the ballpark a little more, and, if we're just guessing now, I think there's more chance that the Phillies between now and the beginning of next season put some more hitters around Hoskins. I mean, I think there's starting to be some urgency in Philadelphia to start seeing some results, and it wouldn't surprise me if they do a little bit of what the Braves did this year. The Braves did it more in their pitching staff, but it would not surprise me if the Phillies decide that while continuing the long-term rebuild view, that they pick up a couple of short-term pieces so they go from a 60-win team to an 80-win team and at least, give a watchable team to their fans. That wouldn't surprise me if in the short term the Phillies made some adjustments and put a little better lineup around Hoskins next year.
Yeah, it does seem like the A's are maybe a little earlier in the same process that the Phillies are now a little later in. And I agree with you. I think it's highly unlikely the A's go in that direction of adding really good pieces. It's interesting because we all know that Oakland's not a great place to hit home runs, yet there have been some guys on Oakland hitting, like with Chris Davis. I mean, a lot of people, I think we spoke negatively about Chris Davis when he switched from the Brewers to the A's, just saying ballpark switch, poor strike zone. And then, boom, a lot of home runs since he's joined the A's. Marcus Semien last year, a lot of home runs. There have been some players, Yonder Alonso earlier this year, a lot of home runs. There have been some players who have, it's not because of the ballpark, but there have been some Oakland A's recently putting up a lot of home runs.
Well, and one thing we know is that organization will be looking for guys who are a fit. Was it 2 years ago when shifting really sort of became the topic that everybody was talking about, and the A's loaded up on right-handed hitters who presumably were harder to shift about? They see these things, and if there are guys where the data that we have now indicate to them there are guys who can be home run hitters in the Coliseum, you better believe they're going to find them and they're going to go after them. That's just the way they operate. So, that I think is worth remembering. Now, Olsen is not a free agent, but, it's not somebody where they pick him up and say, oh, yeah, this guy's a fit for us. But, I just generally talking about the A's and power, they're not going to sign guys that they don't think can hit in their ballpark. That's just kind of the way they operate.
Yeah, if you put a number on it, actually, I just checked it out. Right now, they're tied for third in the majors in home runs this season,
yeah.
Only five behind Baltimore, who's in first, which is just when you look at the teams ahead of them, Baltimore, Texas, the Yankees are tied with them, Houston's tied with them. Like, those teams all have a much more favorable home park. So pretty impressive what they're doing with the long ball in Oakland.
We go to another guy who is not as old as you probably think, Mike Zunino, also in his age 26 season. Another guy just seems like he's been around forever, started young, of course, was a hyped prospect, and is now in his age 26 season and is having a heck of a year. Career high slugging at .501, career high batting average at .248, career high home runs at 23, career high doubles, closing in on career highs in runs and RBI, career high in walks, which is a really nice thing to see. There is a, and I would be curious to know about the data. There is an old baseball adage that may or may not be true that catcher offense can come more slowly, and it makes sense when you think about it. When you just kind of puzzle it out, it makes sense. The idea is that as catchers are developing, they spend so much time learning the craft of catching that they can develop slower as hitters. I don't know if the data support that or not. I do know it is sort of a belief that baseball people have. If you bake that in when talking about Zunino, I'm open to the idea that he is taking a step forward and becoming the kind of guy who is at least a start across all formats. You know, he wouldn't have had to be – the thing is, it wouldn't have taken a big jump. For a catcher with his power, it's not like he's got to hit .280. If he's a – maybe not .230, but he's a legit .240 hitter with this kind of power at catcher, that's the guy you start, right?
It is, if he's a legit .240 hitter, for sure, then it is for sure the kind of guy that you start. I'm still a little skeptical. We've had a lot of BABIP talk today, but his is .358, and previous to his career is .273, so like a huge jump with his BABIP this year. It probably comes back down. He doesn't have a lot of room to play with when you're hitting .248, like before you're back to being a .215 hitter, and that would be my concern. So I think the power is cemented. I mean, really, even last year, 12 homers in 55 games, like the power, like we're not surprised by the power. The question is next year whether he is a .248 hitter again or whether he's back to being a .215 type hitter, which really hurts your batting average. So I think he's into the – I don't think he's cleared the tier of Wellington Castillo and some of those players, Matt Wieters or, you know, that where you're not near – you're not even approaching the top tier at catcher, but you're owned in pretty much every league. I think he's in that tier now, but I don't think he's cleared it.
That's fair. I would say if we're talking about draft day next year, you know, he is in somewhat of a different class from those guys, particularly Castillo, who I think is a low-ceiling, high-floor guy. I think he's the opposite of that. Because if you tell me Zunino hits .240 with 30 homers next year, I'd buy it. I'm not saying I'm betting on it at all, but if somebody said this happens, I'd say, oh, okay, I could see that. That's not shocking. So, you know, I think to some extent, you know, to some extent, I feel like Castillo is maybe more a very low-end number one catcher, whereas Zunino is more a high-end number two. If you have somebody who is safe, then you get him, and maybe he blows up. But, you know, the one worry with him is that they've never been really patient with him. That, to me, as much as a performance risk, if we're talking about Zunino on draft day, part of the worry for me with him is if he struggles and guys with that kind of offensive profile, even if they've taken steps forward, sometimes they're going to hit .180 for a couple of weeks. You know, does he hold on to his job or do the Mariners mess around with him again? That to me is as much a worry as anything.
Yeah, and if there's something, maybe I think he's bought himself this year, is he's bought himself a little more time when that happens.
You would definitely hope so.
For me, yeah. So that if he's hitting .190 at the end of April next year, they can say, oh, well, he hit .250 last year or whatever he ends up at. We'll give him a little more time. Yeah. So I think that's one thing that comes out of this year, BABIP inspired or not, like that's really good for his fantasy value.
Yeah, that's definitely the hope. Daniel Murphy, banged up. The Nationals, well, it's funny, you know, a couple of weeks ago we would have thought the Nationals didn't really have anything to play for right now. Nationals may have something to play for, and I don't know that they're going to be super aggressive going for it, as we saw with the way they handled the Dodgers series last weekend. They didn't exactly pull out all the stops to beat them. But they do kind of have something to play for. They're within 3.5 of the Dodgers, and they hold the tiebreak there. So I still think that if you wanted to sit Daniel Murphy next week because he has been scuffling a bit, because he is a little banged up and they may want to just go ahead and get him healthy, I wouldn't tell you were wrong. But I also think it's worth remembering that, again, the Nats may have something to play for, and that may affect some of their decisions down the stretch.
Yeah, for sure. I just think I maybe I'm personalizing this in a bit because I made a trade for Murphy where I paid a lot for him at the beginning of August. So I've lived through this decline for him, and I still think a lot of Murphy as a hitter. He just isn't fully 100% healthy right now. Like, he's dealing with nagging injuries. They're giving him frequent rest. I know, like you said, they'll probably have a little more to play for than we anticipated. That being said, Dusty Baker still seems to be sticking with the plan of giving him a day or two off a week down the stretch to make sure he's physically at the best he can be for the postseason. So I think if batting average, even though he hasn't been hitting for batting average, I'll actually say, because that's usually his thing, if batting average is really important to me, I'd probably leave him in my lineup. If power is important to me, or like if I just see Murphy as a you can't bench him, I don't feel that way about him anymore for this last week of the season. I think you could bench him if batting average isn't your most important category.
We move on to starting pitchers, and you know, we both sounded a little bit of a note of caution on Corey Kluber coming into the year because of how deep he went into last season, and because it's not unheard of for guys to go deep into the postseason and then show some ill effects. Well, Kluber spent some time on the DL this year. He missed a few starts, and still, 191 innings, 17 wins, 2.35 ERA, 252 strikeouts, 0.850 WHIP. His FIP is 249. He's having a ludicrous year. Where does he rank among 2018 starting pitchers? Is he clearly third? Is he knocking on the door of the top two guys? You know, that to me is a question. Is you've got the sort of you've got the tier of guys behind Scherzer and Kershaw. Is he at the top of that tier? Is he closer to Scherzer and Kershaw? Where do you have him going into 18?
Yeah, I think he's a viable first-round pick. I think that Scherzer, Kershaw, Sale, and Kluber are all viable first-round picks next year. I'm always of the mindset that I would like to pick as high as possible in the first round because you just never know what can fall to you. You might pick second and somehow end up with Mike Trout. I usually just want the highest pick. Next year, early thinking, next year shaping up to me to be a year where I maybe wouldn't mind picking later in the first round and just taking the ace that falls to me and then pairing him with one of those great hitters that we've already talked about today, or a Trey Turner type or something like that, and then a slugger. But I think that those four are almost inseparable right now. I probably lean to the NL guys just because they're in the NL, and I don't know if that, like, as I go deeper into the offseason and look into all the underlying statistics for all four of them, I have a hard time putting Chris Sale fourth on that list after he strikes out more than 300 batters this season. Like really. And the strikeout rates aren't up that much. Like, it's not like this isn't like the home runs where he's striking out 300 and a bunch of other guys are striking out 275.
Right.
I have a hard time putting him fourth on the list after he does that and putting Kluber ahead of him. So to me, they're almost inseparable, and it's almost just, you know, pick the one that you like the most, like we were talking about with those second-round hitters. But I see Kluber in the Scherzer, Sale, Kershaw tier now. Do you see him the same way?
I think that's fair. The only thing I would say is, and again, this is kind of thing where I wish I actually had more data, so it's anecdotal as much as anything. I feel like I have seen, and this may be an off-season topic, but I feel like that those deep October runs can be cumulative. I think about the guy I think of is Chris Carpenter, who, you know, went deep into a couple of postseasons, and then, you know, you start seeing those effects. The only thing that would worry me is if this guy goes to Halloween again and makes, you know, whatever it would be, 5-6 postseason starts and racks up the innings, you know, then maybe I worry a little bit. But at the same time, if he's pitching brilliantly into deep into October, it's hard to say that hurts his value. So, and you know, Kershaw certainly has some injury concerns as well. So, you know, Scherzer actually got a little dinged up for the first time this year, though I think he feels like the safest of those guys, which would have been a really weird thing to say 4 years ago. So,
no,
you know, I wouldn't change it, but I would kind of have it somewhere in the back of my head.
Yeah. No, it's very true. And I also agree with you. And, like, I feel the same way about the deep into October theory that, if you're not Madison Bumgarner, I worry a little bit about you if you go deep into October, which this year backfired a bit with Kluber, although he did start the season slowly. But it did work a bit with some of those Cubs pitchers, like Lester, who hasn't,
yeah.
And Hendricks didn't have a good first half. And so I think that there is something there. And so as weird as it may sound, the pitcher out of those four, the pitcher who does the best in the postseason may be the one that I want the least.
Yep.
Next year, now not necessarily because it may not come with team success, but the one that pitches deep into the World Series or throws the most innings may just move to the back end of my list, which isn't a big insult, but it may be just be that I don't end up with that pitcher in any of my drafts because I take, you know, Sale instead of Kluber or Sale instead of Scherzer or something like that when we see how the postseason shakes out.
Right. I mean, look, we're talking fine margins here. That's
yep.
part of it. Marco Estrada re-ups with the Blue Jays. This seems like a good thing to me. He, despite it not being a great place to pitch, despite it being the DH league, despite that generally being a tough division on pitchers, there's clearly something that works there. Has his resurgence here in the second half been enough to get him back on something of a trusted list for you?
It's getting there, and actually his press conference yesterday where they announced the contract has moved me a little more in that direction. And without going into any specific details, he talked about how he had some problems in his personal life during his slump that he felt heavily contributed to it. And nobody seems to know what they are, and I don't care what they are, really. I trust him when he says that. He's always been a pretty honest guy with the media, and there's some stats to back that up. Like, he was really rolling up to a point and then all of a sudden really struggled and now has really moved through it. And we know that the margin of error is really fine for his skill set. So whatever he was going through, whether it was physical, emotional, psychological, we don't know. But the margin of error is small for him. That'll always be the case. That keeps him out of the top tiers. But he's back, to me, he's back onto the radar of someone who I would want to own in a shallow league.
He could be a great value pick next year, I think. And
maybe.
One thing I would say about Estrada is if home runs correct a little bit next year, he's the kind of guy who could really benefit. We talked about him as a guy earlier this year who maybe was getting hurt by that. A fly ball pitcher in a good park for hitters is the kind of guy where if power adjusts even a little bit, he could benefit more than most.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And speaking of guys who pitch in good environments for hitters, John Gray comes home. Now, the Rockies coming home next week is really good news for them. They are in a postseason race. And having a week at home to finish out the season is really good. It's less good for John Gray. Are you starting him at home next week?
I'm going to say probably not. Like, I hate to be impacted by one start. If he does something really special at Petco Park this weekend, then I'll consider him at home against the Marlins. But the Marlins, to me, are scary enough. Like, obviously the Stanton effect, and you get Stanton at Coors Field. But then even beyond Stanton, like, Marcelo Ozuna's putting the finishing touches on a really nice power season. Justin Boers had a really nice season that was interrupted by an injury, has shown a lot of power as a left-handed hitter who hits righties well. So I'd say I'm probably still benching him, at least in a 10 and probably even a 12-team league. Again, unless I don't care about my ratios that much, it's the last week of the season. Maybe I just want a chance and hope I get 8 strikeouts from him. But I'm still probably a sit. I would be impacted. Like, if he throws 8 scoreless innings against the Padres, strikes out a dozen, I might just ride him and hope that he's just that hot and keeps it going for one more start. But mostly I think I'm still a sit for a home start against the Marlins with him. Are you with me, or would you risk it a little more?
No, I'm not going to get away from my general rule of almost no Rockies pitchers ever at home, particularly because, as you note, the Marlins are not necessarily a great offensive team, but boy, are they the kind of team that can ruin your day. You know, on their day, particularly in Denver, the Marlins are the kind of team that can put a hurting on a starting pitcher. They got a lot of guys who can hit the ball out of the park.
This is a big picture. This is a real cap on, and it always has been and always will be, a big cap on his overall fantasy value. Like, if we feel the same way, if Gray's pitching well next year in May, but we feel the same way where we're not excited to start him on the road, then it really puts a cap on how high you can draft him.
Yeah. Acknowledging bias up front, I am literally wearing a Florida State shirt as we discuss him. So I like Luke Weaver. With that said, he's pitched really well. I am definitely intrigued by him. Is he established as a guy for you?
For me, he is. And this is a little bit of confirmation bias because I was just really high on Weaver before he got this chance. And I was high on him last year when he got brief chances, and he didn't totally take advantage of them. But I remember the schedule didn't really work in his favor. He had to go to Coors and some things like that. But I've always been just really optimistic on him, so I was really quick to jump on board. And then this time I've been right. You're not always right. So far, at least this time, I've been right. So for me, I view Weaver as someone who I think is fairly safe for next year. He's going to be in their rotation. I really like what I've seen from him. I would happily draft him far ahead of John Gray. And I don't think that'll be the total. I don't think everyone will feel that way. Although there's a lot of John Gray fans out there as an example. I think Weaver, for me, I don't know if he could be my number three in a mixed league, but I think he's in that range of three or four. Do you think I'm too high on him, or do you think that's realistic?
No, I think that's reasonable. I think, you know, the worry with him is opportunity. And I'm not really that worried about that, because that team's got a lot to fix. They got a lot of things they need to address. They got a lot of areas that they're going to be looking at to get better. A cost-controlled quality starting pitcher is something that you say, okay, we're good there. We'll go spend money other places. So I have to think that he is a guy that they are counting on having as a part of their 2018. And so, you know, if you like the performance and the opportunities there, then you're in. Rick Porcello has just not had a good year after winning the Cy Young and just looking like, you know, the kind of frustrating pitcher with a lot of ability that he'd been for years, kind of looking like, okay, he's finally put it together, he's taken a big step back this year. So two things. One, as we talk about him right now, he ends the year with a couple of tricky starts. Either one could go really well, either one could go really poorly. At Cincinnati and home for the Blue Jays, those are both sort of risk-reward starts where he could give up one run in seven innings, and he could give up three homers in either of those. First of all, do you trust him for those two starts this year?
Oh, with some trepidation, I will say yes. I definitely trust him for the Blue Jays one. He's at home. The Blue Jays haven't overall hit well this season, especially in the second half. He's not going to face Marcus Stroman, who is the one Blue Jays pitcher I think you can be really counted on to have nice starts right now. So I think I like him for that one, especially if I'm looking for wins. And it's the same thing. If I'm looking for wins, and chasing wins is usually a bad idea, but sometimes you have to do it late in the season, then I'll use him for the at Cincinnati just because that pitching staff is really, really a bit of a mess right now. So for that, if I'm chasing wins, yes. If I'm worried about my ratios, no. And for next season overall, I'm going to say I'm not terribly optimistic. Like when I look at him, he's had a whip below 1.23 once in his career, and it was last year, the Cy Young year. That's it. So you can almost guarantee that he's going to hurt your whip next year at the very least. The strikeout rate's okay. His ERA is usually in the fours. To me, I think he's like down with – lower than John Gray. I think he's like maybe your fifth or sixth starter in a mixed league.
Yeah, to me, you really touched on the key, which is, you know, another year like this. This year is not the anomaly. And what this year does is start arguing that last year was the anomaly. And, mm-hmm. and that is kind of what you have to worry about as you look at what to do about Porcello is, you know, was the good year the outlier? And if so, that's not a guy you can draft real high. We will move on to closers and two-start pitchers in just a minute. Before we do, I want to take a minute to tell you about the MLB Pipeline podcast, which focuses on all things draft and prospect related. MLB Pipeline's draft and prospect gurus, Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. Last week, they gazed into their crystal balls and attempted to predict who will be MLB's top 10 prospects at the end of the 2018 season. To hear who Jim and Jonathan think will already be in the majors by then and who could break out in the next year, search for MLB Pipeline in Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts and click subscribe. Now on with the show, and we have exactly one closer situation to talk about, but it's a pretty big one. It sounds like Zach Britton is going to be shut down for the year. Now, the Orioles aren't very good, but they're still a team that's going to go to their bullpen a lot, a team that can hit the ball out of the yard, a team that can have a few save chances over the final week. Is there anybody you're moving on in Britton's absence?
Yeah, I'll move on Brad Brock. I mean, he has 17 saves this year. You know, this hasn't been his best season, but his ERA is still 260. His whip's 1.07. Like, that's plenty good enough for me to use him if I'm looking for saves in the last week and a half here. I'm not sure if he'll get all their saves and I'm not sure how many there be. But if I had to guess, I would guess that he will get them all and could probably get you two saves, maybe even three, and that could swing the balance in your league. And I think it'll be interesting. We'll see how Britton's offseason goes and if Brock's still on the team next year and everything. But as it stands right now, like if you're taking Zach Britton at some point, who might be a nice buy low next year, you may want to draft Brad Brock in the last round and just hold him at least for a couple weeks in April.
Yeah, I would not be at all surprised to see changes in the late innings for the Orioles next year. Not because they don't like or trust Britton, but because they may just decide to make some changes to make a move, maybe trade him if somebody makes an aggressive offer for him and kind of reassess things and reassess how they spend their money. We move on to the two-start pitchers, and some guys I like in here. Mike Foltynewicz at the Mets, at the Marlins. Parker Bridwell at the White Sox, home for the Mariners. Andrew Cashner, home for Houston and Oakland. Jake Junis at the Yankees, home for Arizona. Daniel Mengden, home for Seattle and at Texas. Blake Snell at the Yankees, home for Baltimore. Bartolo Colon at Cleveland and home for Detroit. You know, this is one where it really will depend on what you need and whether you just want the guy who can get you wins, whether you want strikeouts, whether you're worried about your ratios. That's really obviously got to – if you're streaming and looking at two-star guys, then that's really what you're thinking about. With that said, I really like that Foltynewicz at the Mets, and I don't mind him at the Marlins because although I just talked about how dangerous they are, it's a pretty good ballpark to pitch in Miami. Like Junis, all right. I like the matchups pretty well for Mengden. I like Snell, but I don't trust him, and at the Bronx really scares me. But I kind of like all these guys. There's nobody who jumps out to me as absolutely have to, and nobody who jumps out to me as stay away. How do you see this group?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think that this is obviously the week for owners to get really aggressive with their two-start pitchers. I mean, you might as well go for it. And you can feel free to cut whoever you need to cut to go ahead to grab them in those weekly leagues. And I think also they have to remember, so for example, with Junis, like I'm worried about the at New York, but I'm not really worried about the home to Arizona because Arizona may not be playing for anything by the time he gets to them. He may not face that full Diamondbacks lineup. So I don't mind Junis. I like Mengden. He's been pitching well lately and not walking anyone. So I think that's a nice direction to go in. I think Bridwell is a decent option, and probably Cashner too. We've talked about Cashner a couple times this season where we don't exactly know how he's doing it, but he is consistently going out there and kind of giving you six innings, two or three runs. I could see Cashner, just if he can do that twice again next week and maybe get a win out of there somewhere, that could make a big difference for some owners. Foltynewicz scares me because he's just been really up and down this year, but I do agree with you, the matchups are pretty solid, so he's in that group for me as well. Cologne's the one maybe that scares me a little more. Although the home to Detroit's nice, but overall in Cologne scares me.
Yeah. All right, that's the Fantasy 411 for this week. Good luck to everybody playing in the final week of the season or in your playoffs. Thanks, everybody, for taking the time to listen, and thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk.